The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain. I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters. And it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the Switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. The Afterburn Podcast is sponsored by BogeyDope.com. Launch your aviation career. Have those who've walked the path before you guide you through the application process, the interview process, all the tips and tricks and hidden things that you won't find anywhere else. You can click the link down below. Let BogeyDope.com launch your aviation career. You can use the code Afterburn for 5% off. When you watch making quality timepieces at an affordable price, make your own custom group watch with Wingman Watches today. Click the link down below. You can find one of the many pieces they've already made. Use the code RAIN10 for 10% off or mention my name when you do your group custom build.
Altitude.
Tower Delta Airspace has released you, runway 411, 0040 at 5 for takeoff.
Seat tied. Altitude is 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Well, here we go with another bro chat. You can find Vader and Bender over at the Kodiak Shack podcast. They're dropping a lot of great content. I have their link down below. You should check them out. But as always, thanks for listening in. It seems like people are enjoying these bro chats, so this has probably become more of a regular thing. One aspect we're looking to incorporate is Q&A. So I already have a section up on my Patreon right now for the next round of bro chat and have a few people who are asking questions. If you want to support the podcast, consider Patreon. You can click the link down below. But as always, I just thank you if you go to iTunes and Spotify and drop a rating or review. That also is huge and helps the podcast out. So thanks, my Patreon supporters. And thanks, as always, to those who leave a rating or review. If you have a question and you don't really care where you fit in the queue, you can swing over to theafterburnpodcast.com. I have a contact form up there where you can submit a question and it gets emailed to me. With that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Vader and Bender.
Bro, and then I did. And then now you're doing the intro.
He's got a point. He's got a point.
It's science.
Yeah, it could be. Well... yeah, okay. Well, welcome, everybody. That's all I got this time. See, I'm not a professional. I don't have a studio. Yeah. I got my kids, like, locked out of the bedroom.
Yeah,
Bender, you know me. I got to push mute, like, constantly.
Yeah, you know I'm not a professional. Here, we'll get some audio rolling. Can you guys hear that?
Oh,
look
wow.
At that. Nice. Did you hear that?
That's
look
really
at that.
Nice.
I didn't know I could actually do that for the longest time. I just thought it didn't work. Turns out the volume was at zero, so that's what we're doing.
There are a lot of buttons on that thing.
Yeah.
Well, hey, everybody.
Not a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Well, welcome everybody to Bro Chat Volume 4. If you're following on the Kodiak Shack podcast, we've got Rain and Bender here, and we're all over the map. Rain is, he crossed the pond, the bigger pond too. You got to specify nowadays because it's a big world out there. And then Bender and I are, where we currently are. I'm two flights down in the old C model, which is pretty sweet. I've been... the first day it was supposed to be a torrential downpour. Turns out weather was wrong. And then today it was supposed to be hailing, and turns out they were wrong again. So, so they're batting zero. What's that in baseball? The Mendoza line or something, like below like 200. That's pretty much their batting average.
But they were wrong in the good way, right? At least it was hailing.
Yeah, but we're all kind of like, there was a lot of fog this morning, and we were all kind of like leaning towards like, all right, we're not going to fly. And then we stepped, I think, an hour late, and then it was a beautiful, clear day. So it worked out.
That is better. That's the worst, though, when you kind of get drug along, like, are we going to go? Are we not going to go? Like, let's just make a decision. But I would say it is worse when they are on the wrong side of the weather prediction, that it's, hey, it's supposed to be beautiful, and then it's hailing outside. So at least you got that for you. And you knocked out two flights this weekend, so you're kind of being a little humble. So you managed to start four engines in a matter of like 24 hours.
Yeah, it was a personal best. Yeah, and I hot pitted a lot. So, I actually, in 4 days of work, I will fly three times, which is sadly kind of an outlier. But yeah, it was good. Ground ops are, they're minimal, you know, because you don't have like all the avionics set up with all the like routes and steer points. I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's 11 steer points that you can have and like three pre-plan points. So, I mean, there's not a ton to like avionics wise look at. You know, you got to set up your... Oh, go ahead.
But you have to start two engines. So that's right. Where you spend all your extra time is that second engine you're starting.
And the crew chief helps me too. I'm like, all right, ready for flight controls. He's like, don't forget the other engine. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Today is single engine only. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's all right. It's like get to the end of the runway and then start the second one. Practice for the airlines, right? Because that's what they do, right? Just taxi one engine.
Yeah, you got to save that money. You got to save that money. Yeah. How were the flights?
They were chill. I mean, I humble brag, but I'm just repeating what I was told. But my IP was like one of the better TR1s I've ever flown. I was like, wow. Sick. Yeah, he's been around for a minute, so he's blowing smoke, but I appreciate it. So, but yeah, the ground ops
were just ran out of chalk.
Yeah.
Luckily, 100%
of my debriefs have been in the bar. So we're nailing that. So it's got to be all right. Today, because the first day was like, get to the airspace, do some hard turns. I've told them that I've decided I'm just not going to pull a lot of G's in this airplane because I don't know what is a over G pull and what is a normal pull. So I pull like 6.5 and I'm like, now I'll like rate around at some point. But at the beginning, I'm just not going to pull a lot of G's. And then today it was all instruments. I did a high TACAN, so the full penetration. And like, so in the F-16, for everybody who doesn't know, who doesn't fly. So a normal instrument approach is like for at least fighters is they give you a vector. So they tell you a heading and an altitude, and then you get guidance to fly to the runway. And that's 99.9% of the time we fly an instrument approach. A full penetration approach is like start at 20,000 feet. I don't know. 180, 90 degrees off whatever runway you're going to. And you like kind of arc around and you have to fly all these, you hit these gates, like you're in Star Fox or something, to not get, run into anything. And then you intercept your final, guidance. So in the C model, they, as long as you're VFR, you'll really not use your HUD, you know, in the F-16, you like, oh, don't use your HUD, wink. Like legitimately, like you actually don't use your HUD. So we're like, I'm like nuggets down, staring in the cockpit, just like flying. And I'm like flying down to Mins. I'm like, all right, approaching my TACAN Mins. And they were low. It was 500 feet was the TACAN brought you down to. And he's like, all right, you break out. And I look out the window and I was like, man, this TACAN brings in pretty low. Well, sure enough, we get on the ground. He's like, you got pretty low on the TACAN. So I think it was a couple hundred feet low on the Mins there. But it was good. It all worked out.
Look at you now. A couple hundred feet. Yeah. No big deal.
65% deviation.
Yeah.
You want to be able to see the runway and land, you know? So those are just recommendations.
Yeah. Well, it turns out I looked out the window and I was like, God, all those farm buildings are in the way of the runway. I had to climb back up. But it was good. Good patterns. I did my first. I didn't realize it until I was literally in the touchdown phase and floating long of my aim point that I have not done a no flap since T-38s. And and I was like, gosh, that was like 12 years ago. Like, it's been a minute.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, you have a flap handle now.
Oh man, they still will blow up on their own if you don't raise the switch. So I'm like,
oh,
just leave the switch down. But
yeah, that makes it easy.
Raise the switch.
Yeah, that makes them auto. Wait, do they auto go back down then when you slow down enough?
I think so, but I don't know.
Well, that sounds like automatic flaps to me. Is what that sounds like.
Right. I would imagine you really get some nice maneuverability out of that when you get slow in the fight.
Yeah. Well, there's the, cause the F-16 had the alternate flaps extend, right? And some, I remember B Corps students would forget that sometimes. And then you get like a low speed warning horn when you get slow. And so apparently, I forgot what IP was telling me this, a student has his like alternate flaps extended in the F-16. He's just ripping around and he's just got like the low speed, like, hey, if you hear this tone, recover, like knock the fight off. And he's just fighting in the horn and everything. Good, strong performance.
That's awesome. That reminds me of one of my B course flight mates. We don't go with names on this program, except for every once in a while.
Most of the time,
but we're going to go actually. No name here. Yeah. But he, like, when we got our BFM, like, phase brief, you know, in the B course, they were like, hey, as soon as you get, you know, like, you can get to the horn, and if you, you know, like, run out of it, whatever, you can continue the fight. But if it's a sustained horn, then we're just going to knock off the fight, and we'll, like, redo it again. He translated that to be, like, if I knock off the fight and I'm not dead yet, like, in defense of BFM, then I have won the fight. So his, no kidding, he would fights on break. Like roll wings level and then get to the horn as fast as he could and then knock the fight off, thinking like that was winning the defensive BFM. He hooked that ride and then they explained like, no, that's not the intent of your defensive ride.
I love the creativity though. That's impressive. Not going to work against a bad guy, but you know.
Yeah. At some point there's just the gamesmanship where you're like, I don't know if we're meeting the intent anymore.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because like, wasn't it like IFF and then probably the B Corps? Like, well, I guess everything is like survive, you know, for defensive BFM. So technically,
yeah,
he did survive all the way to the knock it off, but it's just not going to work in real life. So, yeah.
Which there's a lot of BFM that may work exactly that way. Like there's modified. I don't know, threats. I won't get into it because I'm new to it and I'm not going to complain about it. But Rain, you just, are you well rested after your over 14-hour flight, which cannot be the most enjoyable thing?
Well, you know, it's a trade-off with the long flight versus a short flight. And my definition of long versus short flight has drastically changed over the years where, you know, I was good for like a 17-minute flight back in the day. Now it's 14 hours. But those 14-hour flights, you do get to sleep a little bit, which is kind of nice. But it starts getting pretty trippy because right now I'm in Japan, so I'm in the future. I would tell you guys what it's like, but I don't want to spoil anything. Nope. It gets really weird trying to balance schedules on the road and doing interviews and things like that when you're like, well, right now, like it's Monday morning at 8:14 in Japan. I don't even know what time it is in California, but I know, again, you guys are way back in the past, so...
Yeah,
It's a different world.
Yeah.
What stocks should we buy for tomorrow? Yeah. That's the real question.
I think that's insider trading. I'll tell you after we get off this. That way it's not documented.
Yeah. What are those winning lotto numbers? Somebody told me 1.9 billion.
That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's a big time to be in the future because we got the elections coming up, that's the lottery. Right, yeah. I mean, I'm kind of a guy who's in the know. So
that's right. Yeah.
Just saying.
Everybody's listened to this after the fact. They're going
to
miss out.
Yeah, that's the sad part. I mean, you're listening to this 5 days after we recorded it, but you just know I'm in the future.
So longest sorties before you joined the airlines?
I don't think I have one that's that impressive because I didn't do a long, like pond crossing AOS movement. I did Dubai to Speng Dalem, which was probably 8 hours, 8.5 hours. I did an 8 hour combat sortie. That was my longest sortie, but I didn't do any of these like crazy, you know, Misawa to wherever you guys went. You guys, got me smoked on that.
I think Bender and I were on the same, at least it was my longest sortie. I don't know if Bender had a longer one, but was it 12 and a half? Something like that.
Yeah. And that was after delaying on the ground for 2 hours. So it was like in the seat for almost 15 hours. Like I could barely walk when I climbed down that ladder.
My 14 hour sortie, I did get 2 3-hour rest periods.
Yeah.
And I could like stand up multiple times. What was your rest schedule on that sortie?
I rested my eyes a couple times. I, you know, set the autopilot and the heading bug and just hope I didn't get close to anyone. Well, one of our buddies, I don't know if it wasn't on this AOS, like a pond crossing or traveling across, but one of the guys, he got tired of hearing us talking to each other on Ox. So he just like turned his radio all the way down and sort of like, hey, do you think number, whatever he was, number five, like, is he okay? Like someone need to rejoin on him. And sure enough, he just didn't want to listen to us. He was like, I'm so over just people talking. Yeah, that was a long one. What was it? Our squadron commander at the time, Torch, I think he got the McKay trophy for like a 17 hour sortie, something crazy, like hill to Afghanistan or something. Bender, do you remember?
I know he got the McKay trophy. I didn't think it was for the duration. Maybe it was, though. I thought they went somewhere from the sandbox to Afghanistan and then back.
Maybe so that's like what it
one
was.
One of the longest strike missions in a fight or something. But
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. But he did. He won the trophy.
Were they out of B2s that day?
Yeah, I never understand.
Someone's got to win the McKay trophy. I think they mission planned specifically. They're like, hey, all our submissions so far for this trophy are not that great. Somebody go fly 7 hours, drop some JDAM, and come back, and we'll give you the trophy.
Like what?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I talked to a B-52 pilot, and I think I'm probably screwing this up, but we'll call it truth. He said he flew like 32 hours or something crazy in the B-52.
So in some of the logbooks that I've seen in my day, there are some hot bomber guys with like in like 28 hour, like single sortie missions. I'm like, what the, like, how is that? Especially in the B2 when they're doing over 20 hours or whatever they're doing. And they don't have, you know, like a backup pilot. It's just those two. I don't even think they might have a bunk or something back there, but
I don't think they do. I think they just have like a lawn chair and just a bucket of go pills.
I think they get
the good stuff. Go pill last.
Yeah. Right. Like they just get like three go pills squished together. Yeah. The thing that would piss me off is having to wear like a fighter type helmet in one of those airplanes. Like if I'm going to sit in like a B-52 or B-2 or something, like just let me wear like some Bose noise canceling and chill out. Right. Like don't make me wear like a face mask in a airplane that's made to be pressurized. And you know what I mean? I don't get it.
I never took my helmet off flying like a 7 hour combat sort ever.
Never. I would never do that. Or think of doing
I'm
that.
Done with this right now. With you got access to earplugs, it's like your Bose headset right there. You're like, hold my helmet up and talk right now. I'm just not in the mood.
Yeah. Even
like my last sorties in the F-16, like as soon as I would land at Shaw, I would just take the thing off, like just taxi back. And then, of course, the next pilot meeting, you're like, we've noticed people taxiing around without their helmets on. Like, please put them back on. I'm like, I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I would wave at people. They'd be like seeing me taxi by, and I'm like, hey, what's up? Like, yeah, my helmet's off. I'd like it though. It was nice. It would be nice and cool, like especially night sorties, and you just feel like the nice, like cool cockpit air, you know. And you're like, man, okay, back to work, you know. So I can't get a 15-minute break. Especially when you're not even dropping that much. I mean, Rain, did you ever get a chance to clean your rails?
Yeah, we did. I mean, it's quite a bit. You know, like you guys really paved the way for us and just set the good foundation. Cause then it was like, you like realize you're spoiled. Like you come back and you're like, I only dropped 2 bombs today. I couldn't go supersonic over Raqqa. Cause we do like Kobani. And then the plan was to come back south, like through the superpower lane, as we started calling it, you know, right down the middle of Syria. And you would go supersonic over Raqqa just to let them know we're coming for you. But if you had bombs on the rails, like you couldn't do that. And usually then it was the penalty. You had to go back to Iraq, hit the tanker and drive all the way home. But if you like clean the rails and you did it at an appropriate time with your fuel state, just go supersonic on the way back home. Man. Sometimes like a JTAC up there, we won't mention names, but I was flying with a guy. Great individual. It was a relatively boring day, but he, no kidding, told the JTAC, we each drop one and then we're like putzing around. And he goes, hey, we really want to go supersonic, but we got to get rid of these bombs. And like within about 5 minutes, he's like, hey, there are 100 fighters that just crossed the river and they're in these 3 buildings. I want 6 bombs. And you're like, yes, this is perfect. I assume there were a lot of fighters in those buildings, but it was just perfect timing to clean the rails so we go back supersonic. You know, sometimes you just have to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was our problem, apparently.
Yeah. All that's the way. All these guys do these deployments, they don't drop a single bomb. Sometimes you just have to ask.
See, I got in trouble for that. So my second deployment, I was a little more, I mean, Bender, you were there. So, but I was definitely a little jaded, a little over it by the end of the first one. Cause it was cool. It was exciting to start doing combat sorties and then night after night of doing nothing. I mean, I just sit there and be like, all right, I'm bored. And Bender, good on you. You were like, let's do work, you know, let's like find stuff. And I just like try to get my targeting pod to like point at the moon so I could look at the moon and stuff. And just a complete waste of my time. But the reality was I didn't have the right like mental, like mind state or mental model, however you want to look at it. So the second time I went, I was like, all right, like I'm going to really be hungry. I'm going to ask people, you know, like, hey, you need some help. So, there was a period of time where their, jets were doing DCA. So defensive counter air when Russia was in, Syria. So we had Syria and Russians flying in Syria, and then ISIS is on the ground and the US is fighting ISIS and Russia is fighting ISIS. But we have to do DCA just in case something goes sideways. So you're not dropping bombs. You're just doing air to air. And I'm capping over top while Strike Eagles are down below, dedicated to DCA. So what do I do? Or CAS rather. So close air support. So I roll up their JTAC frequency and they get a 9-9. So I just follow along. So I like type in the coordinates and I'm like taking all the information down. And they're like, all right, you know, readbacks, line 4 and 6. So line 4 and 6 would be like the elevation and then the coordinates. And like a long time goes by and they don't say anything. And the JTAC's like, hey, you know, I think they were dude flight at the time. They're like, hey, dude flight, you know, let me know when you're ready to read back 4 and 6. And they're like, okay, stand by. And then like another minute goes by and I'm like, hey, whatever, you know, like Weasel One is ready to read back. And he's like, Weasel, this is not your frequency. So I had to leave, but I tried. I did everything I could.
Bangs to the floor.
Hey, you know, I wasn't going to miss out.
Yeah. You never know. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You really don't. There are a lot of good dude flight stories in Iraq and Syria. Which yeah. I assume a big portion of your listener base might, you know, be involved in those aircraft. So I won't go into too many of them, but they're needless to say, two people does not equal double the SA in an aircraft.
It's usually a division sign.
Yeah, it's like multiplying fractions. That's right. So the number, the SA gets smaller.
Well, speaking of, this is a perfect segue. So anybody who stays in kind of paying attention to the aviation stuff. So the KC-46 just flew with one pilot. So theoretically, if our math is correct, that pilot had 100% of the SA because he or she was alone. So again, I've only flown single seat aircraft. I got my CTP, but that's not saying much. So what do you guys think, having experience, like actually flying crewed aircraft? What does that say to you?
Bender, do you want to start?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be that single pilot for sure.
Yes.
But maybe I think you could probably hack it, but who wants that responsibility?
Like, I think it's one of those things too. It's completely doable, but also I do have a few questions. Like, having flown big old fat planes, I would not be the one who was selected to go fly that single seat for sure. Like, just based on lack of capability. So I'm sure there's someone out there who is well within the realm of their like capableness to go out there and do it. But it's like one of those like launch for survival. Okay, yep, I can go launch for survival and get this plane away from here and it's going to be fine. But if this is something that's going to become normal, and I don't want to be like the guy on the front porch with the rocking chair saying this is impossible, but it seems like we're buying a lot of risk. Like, flying these big planes, like, a lot can go wrong. Like, they're very reliable, but when it does go sideways, it's really nice to have at least one, if not two or three other people up there, because you're not flying this like you are a fighter. Like, you're like when you fly an Eagle, a Lightning, a Viper, like, you're in it and you're strapped into it. When you're flying these big old planes, vast majority of the time it's just sitting there on autopilot, which is why they're, you know, going down this road and doing all this autonomy. But it just seems like really out here on a limb, like, what's the point? And I haven't read, and that's the other thing too. It's like, I haven't dug down into the whole reasoning of why they're doing it. I have some assumptions, which might not be in line with what a lot of people, leadership thinks. But, you know, if it's a, hey, we need the capability to launch this thing in case a base gets attacked. Okay, I buy that. Like, you can train someone. Like, that's definitely in the realm of possible and makes sense. Like, hey, you want to get this asset away from here. But it becomes like a normal operation thing. I think that's just a recipe for disaster with our current technology and what's currently available. Like, the KC-46 is a 767 that was a refueling platform in the civilian world that took 20 years to reach IOC in the Air Force, plus or minus. So that's my rant.
Yeah, the other thing, I'm sure the technology is there, whatever. I'm sure.
For sure.
But the infrastructure or the culture isn't there. That makes sense. Yeah. So like, we go fly single seat, but there's three guys in the air with me. So there's a four ship or a two ship, and we know how to talk to each other in certain ways to be helpful to the other aircraft. You know what I mean? And then there's softs that are trained specifically to deal with fighters. You know, there's all that infrastructure behind the scenes that makes it so that a single seat fighter can, you know, minimize the risk of there just being one pilot. In the KC-46, like, he doesn't have a wingman. I mean, I don't know what the cockpit looks like, but my guess is that not every switch that he might need to hit is sitting in front of him. It's probably, and I guarantee you, they don't have like HOTAS, at least not like a, you know, developed HOTAS like we would be used to. And I can't even approach understanding like what is the benefit? Like, what are we trying to, is it take a lot of time to get two people to run out to a KC-46 to launch to survival, like, versus one? You know, like, it's not hard. I gotta be careful what I say here, but you can get, I don't know. To get two pilots into that airplane pretty quick seems like not, like, that's not the obstacle to their efficiency, right? You know,
because again, like, the cost of like a pilot is cheap, especially compared, not like life wise, right? But like, we should have enough pilots to go out there and do this. So the question begs, like, why can't we've done it for 70 years. with alert crews and things like that to get these people to planes. So like, do we really need to be able to do it? But the ergonomics of it, I think that's a great point. You know, the Airbus, the 350 freighter, Airbus is, you know, touting that as the first single pilot airliner, you know, that's going to come out. I think it's 2026 is what they're saying. But I would imagine that is going to, it will have the ergonomics to support one pilot in the seat that can get to everything they need to get to. And like, while you can reach the hand, the gear handle in a 777, like one seat has to lean further than the other. And again, it's not like a deal breaker, but I would agree that the cockpit is probably not structured to have that. So what is the point? Like, you're buying all this risk for what? And I'm not educated enough on it. So if someone out there is, you know, please chime in and tell me.
Yeah. One thing I will say before giving my perspective and what I've seen is we have had a lot of feedback from people, you know, when I say stuff that's like not exactly correct, people always kind of reach out and say like, hey, this is reality, yeah. Which I'll correct something here in the future. But yeah, I've been reading a little bit, very, very briefly on it, but it sounds like they view it as needing to allocate one pilot into crew rest to fly lines is going to enable them to fly more aircraft. I think we almost always have more pilots available than aircraft available. So I don't get it, especially when there's loadmasters, boom operators. Like, it's not where it's like a B1 becomes a single seat and it's just a pilot, or a B2 is now a single. Like, I get that. And I think you're exactly right. The layout of the cockpit is not built to be single seat. One of the things I was reading the comments, which sometimes there's gold in there, and in this case there definitely was. It was on LinkedIn about this article, and one person, which I didn't even think about this, but he had a good perspective. He was like, what, how does the FAA feel? Because apparently McConnell flew a plane like already, like I actually did this. And he's like, the FAA certified that pilot and plane to fly not in accordance with its FAA requirements, you know, because again, if I'm like in a jet and I don't have all my required stuff to fly, I can't, you know, you can't take a fighter into reduced vertical separation minimums, RVSM. You just can't do that because you don't meet the requirements. So now we're talking, you know, did they just kind of getting, you know, step on their themselves because they got ahead of themselves and did something that they probably shouldn't have. But I didn't even think about the FAA because I normally don't think about the FAA. But
yeah, you know, that's a really good point, because we talk about like ADS-B. I think that was a big concern for the Air Force for a while. I don't even know what the final justification was, but you know, like the fact that everyone has to have ADS-B, bring the Air Force up to that level, you know, and the fighter aircraft in particular. There's some security things and a lot of challenges just to make that happen. And then we talk about GPS and operating the national airspace system. Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I say it's interesting, the fact that like, I don't get the point. Someone will chime in with, I think you're just buying unnecessary risk. If you need, if we're worried about launching for survival, I go with Bender. Like, we probably have two dudes sitting around the squadron that can do that. And if not, like, all right, yep. In the time of like a base attack, let's get this plane out of here. Go do it and you'll figure it out. So that just seems like you don't even need the permission to do it. You just do it.
Which maybe I'm wrong. Bender, back me up. But I think ADS-B kind of just like went over and we didn't do anything. Cause like right now there's no transmit out of fighters currently. So you can fly with like a little Stratus puck, which looks like a, I don't know, like a, just a rectangular GPS puck that will, is a GP, is a ADS-B receiver. So you can see other people, but fighters still don't transmit. So I know there's like a plan for it, but I don't know what the reality is.
I think RAPCON, at least at Shaw, like they were putting like not artificial, but like they would artificially pump your feed, so to speak, out for the flight lead based on the squawk, but no one else is squawking in the four ship. So there's three other little metal objects flying at 400 knots that no one else sees.
They don't need to see that. They don't want to see that.
Especially because they're probably not within one nautical mile and 100 feet of number one's altitude anyway. So it's just going to get people in trouble.
Yeah. It's a recommendation only. Well, I wonder if that is true, because there are people open source sharing F-35s flying around in Europe. You know, they always do the flight trackers, and it's usually only like the big old fat planes. I think one recently was drawing things in the sky around a Russian base or near a Russian base. They had on F-35. So I imagine they're taking those squawks and pumping those into the system so that people can see them. I don't know.
Yeah.
Need someone who's smarter than me.
Yeah. I think that was the plan, to like route it through, pretty much like scrub it and then send it out just positional data or something like that. But even then, positional data, you know, of your fight is probably like, oh, well, that's, you know, not great, especially if like somebody else is listening to like the radios, you know, and you're like, right. Oh, I have the radios and I have the lines. This is suboptimal. But yeah, one thing I said on a previous podcast that I kind of just, I conflated two things that weren't exactly the same with JADC2 and ABMS. And then I had one of our listeners who's awesome was like, hey, technically, and I'm probably going to mess it up now, but JADC2 is like the overall, like the joint, pretty much like Link 16, like combat web. And then ABMS is like the Air Force's side of that, like replacing the air battle management in the Air Force. So that was just something that I was like, oh, I didn't know that. Cause I was like, oh, there's the same thing, which, you know, effectively they're not. But.
And I learned something.
Look at that. I probably said it wrong again and I'll get some more feedback.
Yeah, got to get that feedback.
That's right. I appreciate it.
I'm just waiting for it to wow it. Like, when's the last time an Air Force program came out and everybody was like, wow, like that's amazing. It works just like they told us it was going to work. And we're bored. Like you know, even our best, you know, obviously the F-35 didn't come out to shoot like that. We're still peddling our way to legitimacy, but so it's funny. JADC2 is going to come out and be like, wait, this is like a 30-year-old, this is basically Link 16 and it probably isn't going to work very well. You're like, okay, good.
I mean, I go back to the old KC-46. It's a known platform. I need to figure out what the difference is between, you know, the KC-46 platform and the civilian tankers that are doing contract. I imagine the whole civilian ones have the boom operator. I think in the traditional spot, like in the back of the tail versus what the KC-46, like the TV screen, I think I'm making this up, just pure assumptions here. So again, probably wrong, but again, essentially a plane that's been around for 3+ decades, 2 decades as a tanker, and we aren't quite wowed by its capability and performance. Like this one should have been a freebie. This has been like here you go. It's amazing. It's not developing something completely from scratch, but you know, I digress.
No, I think that's the thing that's frustrating though, because if we try to do anything other than buy it exactly off the shelf, it takes decades. I mean, right. Two examples that are like fresh in my mind are the E-7. So the E-7 is a wedge tail, which, who makes it? Boeing? No. Boeing?
Is it a 7-3 or is it a Gulfstream?
No, it's huge. I mean, do Gulfstreams come in huge size? But yeah, they're,
I don't think so.
Maybe it's an Airbus. I don't know. I'm not we were just talking about how I can't tell the difference between like an A321 versus a 737. I'm like, no clue. Like,
I know what a 777 looks like, and it took me a long time to figure that out. So,
yeah. Well, the E3 was awesome technology like over a decade ago. It has a ESA, so an electronically scanned array radar. So, where an AWACS.
You said E3. The E3 is not 10 years old, right? That's.
No, it's old. I mean, it was Australia had it when
we're talking about the E7 right now.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. E3 is not awesome.
Yeah. Correct. I'm like, E3, like, that's, yeah.
This thing's amazing.
Get that record straight.
Yeah, let's fix that. So another correction to my list. Yeah, that's what you hope for. The but the E3 is older. It's the traditional AWACS that you would know, the big dome on top that rotates with a big radar. But it's old. I mean, they have block 30s and 40s apparently, and the block 40s mainly do like the kingpin and all that kind of control downrange. So I was like, oh, that's cool. But the E7 has been the newer variant of it for decades now, and has an ESA radar, so it's wildly more capable. And the Air Force is just buying the exact off-the-shelf model without changing a thing. And they're like, we may get, I forgot what year it was. It was like 2026 or something. They'll get two tails. And then by like 2030 or 35, they'll get like four or six. But they're not changing a thing. This is like just a new old aircraft, and you're like, sweet. And then the Strike Eagle, or the, not the Strike Eagle, but the F-15 EX, I found this out the other day, which that may be in my future, is it's a Saudi F-15, just a new one. But again, exactly the same, everything they bought. So it is not like, hey, we made it so it can like maneuver more because the Saudis want like a little more conservative flight control system. Nope. Everything just same. And so we're not like upgrading it. What I found is it's just a new Strike Eagle. Like that's what it is. And I was like, well, shoot.
Really? So it still has conformals and all that stuff. Like, so it's just a big old mama jama.
Well, the first buy didn't even have the conformals in the purchase. So it won't have conformals, just because they didn't buy them. but yeah, at some point it will effectively be the new Strike Eagle, and I think it's 129s. Somebody told me they thought it was 229s, but yeah, 129s would not be bad, but really 229s. Yeah, I mean, They're still, like, I would prefer the 129, but I was hoping it would take like what the Strike Eagle, you know, computing power used to be. And like, if nothing else, just have better computing power. But right. It doesn't sound like that's the case. But again, this could be more incorrect information from your friend Vader. So who knows?
Yeah. You have to go to the meme pages, because the meme pages will tell the truth.
That is where the truth is, which I just found the, what's the Intel one called? That one's hilarious.
I don't know.
Intel chick.
Oh, the Intel chick? Oh, yes.
That's I'll have to find
searing,
it.
Searing memes.
There's some good stuff in there.
Yeah, they're on point. And you're just like, yes. The meme pages have a lot of truth there, you know? There's some that, you know, can fray and get on the fringe there, but if we want to get a pulse of what's going on in the world, the meme pages.
Oh man, they have been roasting senior leadership for a good 2 years now. And it's, I mean, aggressively so, to the point where I'm like, oof, like that may be a little too far even for me.
Well, there's some like the ones for AETC that are just like, yeah, the gloves got ripped off and thrown away in the shredder years ago. The KC-46 is getting a little bit of heat, that's for sure, with the whole single pilot. That's how I get most of my knowledge, and everything I've talked about to this point is via the memes. But yeah, it's spicy.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, we should learn how to cut stuff into the podcast, like clips of things. Because if we could bring that one video clip where it's like the, I don't know what, like they're probably Iranian, some Arab speaking like talk show where they talk about the block plan at Red Flag.
I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen that one?
Where it's like completely just over the top. Yes.
Yeah, let's cut to that. Yeah. So if we do figure this out, we can put it in right now.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, we can do that. I'll tell you what, Rain, your editing chops are solid. The video you sent about me telling that one story, and it had like night videos of Vipers. I was like, man, that's way more impressive than just me telling a story. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you know, happy to serve. I need to get, so this, cause this is on your platform. If I get the raw ones, you know, we can do some of the, take some of these little snippets and throw in there. And I think, Bender, that is a great idea because I completely forgot. Like that one really went around from, it was the one also to whatever World War II movie that has like Hitler who's just like losing his mind in the briefing room. Like there's good tanking plans on that. There's all sorts of like just great. So those memes, I don't know if you call those memes. I'm getting old.
Yeah, but I don't know what you call those. They're good though.
Yeah. Well, Bender, I remember that one where the guy has that really like raspy laugh and he's like almost missing teeth. I thought it was like a Spanish talk show or something, but yeah, that was, yeah. Was that the one you're talking about?
Just laugh.
That's the one.
Yeah. Where he's
like,
just,
we put the Raptors at 20 and they're like living their best life.
Yeah.
The weasels are in the four block.
Yeah. Falling out of the sky. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah. Which I feel like, well, actually the other day I was talking about doing TI above 30,000 feet in an F-16. And I was like, that's about as big of a waste of time as you can experience. Just, I mean, cause you can't turn. I don't know.
You can't do anything. It's like, having to go to the tanker in Iraq when you're like at 29,000 feet and you're like, well, I'm in just min AB, out of min AB. So I don't smash the boom and just back and forth. Like, am I really like getting gas or am I just burning more gas? I did have a really good experience tanking. Have you guys ever rejoined on a tanker that's refueling Hornets?
Oh no.
Yeah.
That one.
It was, with the basket? No, I don't think I actually
have. Yeah, it had the basket, and I didn't realize there were Hornets on it. Like, it was nighttime. I was visual. I kept my radar locked, but I was just rejoining, and, I mean, I was screaming in there. Turns out the Hornet flies slow, so I overshot like a big dog, but that was,
That's, I didn't realize that they would. Why can't they get gas at 310? That seems... It's not like it's the A-10, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It was like two. I think they're like a 280 or something there, which, I mean, it's not crazy, but I wasn't anticipating that end game to have an extra 30 knots to get rid of. Is it not usually back it off a little bit, bring the fangs up out of the floor, you know, a little conservative, but I was not that night.
Did you, we used to fly to the tanker in Iraq with, I think Jikto started the game. Jikto good. Oh, dropped the name there. Great dude. He'd be like, okay, you could set a fuel flow and then you'd start the rejoin to the tank. And yet, so we'd go to the opposite size of the fuel container and you'd be like, okay, now set whatever it was going to be like 4,200 pounds per hour or whatever. Then as soon as it was set, he'd say fights on. And then we'd turn to the tanker and whoever, you couldn't touch the throttle or anything. You just had to use your best geometry to guess where the tanker was going to be at the time of the rejoin. And then whoever got to the boom first got to take gas first and won the contest or whatever. It's good times.
Oh, man. So simple little games, you know, they keep you going and they all often get lost. I only had one, like I remember it was a B1. We're coming out of Syria and I was with, I won't say his name, even though you already said a name, but I was leading to the tanker and it was all I had. I was just pure geometry, but like you could see the B1 and we're like, hey, can we go first? Like, and then the radio crackled or broke up. And so I was like, well, I'm gonna take that as a yes. And so we just slipped in. But like, otherwise we've been there for like 30 minutes waiting for this B1 to get gas just so they could go home. That's all they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, probably 30 minutes for them to get the rejoin done. And then
gas.
Another 30 for the gas.
Yeah.
I read some article where it was talking about, I think it was talking about a C-17. He's like, yeah, it usually takes us about 15 minutes to fill up. I'm like, that's not true. That can't possibly be true. Even like sitting on the wing watching Strike Eagles get gas, you're like 40 minutes later, like, holy crap, please. Like,
it's a lot of gas and
fuel.
Once we refueled behind some Emirati Vipers, so it was a four ship of Emiratis, and we were 2 miles in trail of them doing the strike. And number three couldn't get on the boom. And we were just looking like, all right, we're about to roll. Like, we rolled like Baghdad bingo, just trying to like hang out as long as we could. Those things take so much gas with that big old motor. And it's still, I mean, it just takes forever. It's like, dude, just give number four 2,000 pounds and then we'll get our gas and then you guys can deal with this again. Like, we must move along here.
Yeah. Well, I heard I was showing up. There were two Strike Eagles who there was like a thunderstorm over their base. So they were just sauntering, which we showed up to the ATG just to saunter too, because we weren't going to do anything. And I was like, do you guys just want to saunter here and I can just go home? But, you know, so whatever. So they're like sauntering like 30 miles in trail of me. And they're like working, trying to get enough gas just to pretty much not weather divert. So they're like, hey, you know, we think the weather would be good enough to go home in about an hour. And they're like, all right, let us know how much you need to like hang out for another hour. And they're like, hey, 40K should hold us over for another hour. And I was like, 40K is like my entire formation's offload for the night. And, you know, we're getting
three refuelings.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like we're taking like maybe 8K, you know, each time we go. And so it's like this is crazy. But they're like re-rolling tankers and stuff to like redo the gas plan, you know, because an extra 40K kind of throws that off. I remember one night, because like your tanker doesn't always stay, you know, and especially at the beginning when Bender and I were there, tankers would like bounce. So they'd like give you gas. They'd fly across the country, give someone else gas, and they'd come back. And so Bender knows who this is, but I won't say who it was. We like hop off the tanker and he's like set like 385 or something, like airspeed. And I was like, and I'm looking at the gas plan and I'm like, okay, we cannot get gas early because the tanker is not there. So like this can't happen. So I'm like, So I'm like holding max endure like 310 knots or something. And I was like, okay, see ya. So I'm like 40 miles in trail, just like stripped. And I'm like, nah, I'm not doing it. Well, sure enough, he's like, all right, I'm going to go to the tanker. And he's like, where's the tanker? And I was like, I think it went to this like other tanker track. And he's like, what? And I was like, yeah, on like the like tanker flow, it says they're on their way back from like this tanker track that's like 200 miles away. And he's like, well, I'm going to go now. So he like meets them like 150 miles across Iraq to get gas early. And I was like, well, that's, you know, so it's, I mean, it gets sporty sometimes.
Did you ever do one of
the Wild West? I mean, we didn't even have like tanker frequencies, so like we're trying to like, it was just like find somebody somewhere, please give us some fuel.
Yeah, you guys really ripped the band-aid off. Did you ever do a tanker turn on, like where they do the turn? I only did this once. It was terrible. Like they needed to practice the turn. It's like, sure. And then when they turned 7 miles in front of us, when they rolled out, we're like, this is going to be painful as we run you guys down for the next like 20 minutes, just burning gas. Like, could you do some S turns or like some 90 left, 90 right, just to give us some distance? Yeah. Tankers. They're great. They're absolutely great. But man, sometimes really causes a lot of stress.
There's variability in like how quickly they start the turn. Cause I would use like roughly 13-ish miles. Like they would roll out right in front of you. And, so you'd be like, hey, start your turn now. And then you'd watch them and like on your radar, it's like just tracking forward and you're like, oh no, like this is not good. And because it's like when you say turn now, it's like start, like crack the wings. And so even if it's like a 2 or 3, like 2 mile delay, which when you're collapsing range at close to 1.5 the speed of sound, like it's happening fast. And so there'd be times where it'd just be like this bomb burst at the tanker because everybody goes like one person goes one circle, one person goes two circle. That was great. That was coming out of Kuwait. I had one dude turn him and it was like 19 miles. And he was like, yeah, start your turn. And they did exactly what he asked him to. And I was like, we are like 11 miles in trail. And I was literally like checking my fuel and like checking my fuel gauge on like how much I can get home with. And we barely caught up and got gas before we could not make it back home. And I was not happy.
You know, this is a good thing to talk about fifth gen and why it's great, because non-combat tanking story, I was going to Heritage Flight out in Tucson. So the way we normally flow that is we'd meet up with the tanker over Nashville. And so on this day I had a wingman as my safety observer. And then I think your former DO was going out as like leadership. It was the most beautiful day you've ever seen in your entire life. There's not a cloud in the sky. And the tanker is holding over the Nashville VOR. I go to rejoin. Number two goes blind, over the VOR. I have no idea where he is. I can't find him. Number three can't find him. The Raptors are coming in from Langley up high, and they're going to descend down and rejoin with us on the tanker. But it took the Raptors to find my wingman and then to like get him a PAR back to the formation of like where we were, and just like, you know, five jets screaming over Nashville, taking up like 5,000 feet of altitude. I don't know if I think that's still Atlanta Center, you know, so they're still just like relatively busy with a lot of planes on the Eastern Seaboard, but you know, made it happen. Fifth gen.
Yeah.
They're there for the save.
Need to clear these airways out for the next 15 minutes or so. Yeah.
I'm sorry. We need a 15,000 foot altitude block over Nashville now, please.
Yeah. Bender, how are fifth gen only wingmen when they have to do visual type things?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. I'll be honest, like fifth gen wingmen, they're actually pretty good. Like, it's fun to make fun of women. So that's my one caveat. Now I'm just going to make fun of women the entire time. But you would like, cause I think IFF, they went down the track of like, oh, fifth gen don't need IFF basically. Right. I don't know if that's like still the thing, but they were like, yeah, IFF principles, like they don't apply to fifth gen because, you know, we never fight that close together. So I think some of them just went, you know, pilot training just to the B course without ever doing IFF.
Wow.
Which is funny because we do spend, I mean, the majority, 40 minutes of your sortie is flying, you know, to and from the airspace, 1 mile visual, you know, to your flight lead. So it turns out you actually do that quite a bit, but, I think my first couple four ship rides in the T-38, we had some pretty heinous rejoins, but F-35 rejoins post flight, like post fighting, like after the knock it off. They are insane. They're so bad. It's just like, because everybody's like pretty lethal. We're really good at being like 10 miles from each other and like flying really well. And then it's like, everybody's clear to join. And there are just airplanes going everywhere. And you have to call like visual, you know, once you're within like 5 miles and 5,000 feet or whatever. So it's like three visual two, whatever, blind on one or whatever. Well, two's visual one, blind on three. So like every day is like this. It's just like, and then eventually... they're just like circling over each other and they see everybody sees each other and then we finally get individual formation, but it's not the cleanest part of sorties generally getting back into a visual formation.
Luckily you've got plenty of gas to work that out.
Lots of gas. Yep. And it's also we had some like the Limex guys, so they go fly the Viper for, so they're waiting in the Viper for like a year and then they come over to the F-35. They are, or at least some of the funnier post fight flows, if you will, come from those guys who they know like what it should be like in like the fourth gen world, but they're not like used to being as autonomous as the fifth gen Bubbas who like never ever look outside their airplane. So like to have those guys, we had one and he was just like, it was his first sortie and he's like, bingo, like cool. Like in a fifth gen wingman would just like go home. Most wingmen would at this point, like once they've experienced, but this guy was like, I said, bingo, like, what should I do now? Like, copy. He's like, one, two is bingo. I'm like, one copy is your bingo. Like, I didn't understand. Like, I have closed the loop. Like, what do you want me to do at this point? And then he just turned and followed me. And he's like, I'm bingo minus two. I'm like, okay. Like, obviously, like, we're not understanding what's happening here. So he like flew himself below, like well below the fuel because he was waiting for us to get back to visual and like the head back home together or whatever. It was kind of funny. I'm like, how did you not understand, you know, like go home. Like if you don't have the gas, like go home. When most fifth gen wingmen, like they're pretty good. Like they understand, I think, kind of how to make that happen.
That's good because, you know, I think, you know, this is a spear that's, it's unwarranted, but it's happened a lot of times. Wingmen don't know how to take themselves home. So, you know, it may have been one of those things like, I didn't review how to get home because you're leading me. So I'm just going to wait. You know, I mean, I've been there before, like, nah, I'm not trying to leave right now. Like I got my LAO at Nellis for a red flag was I like reach out. I'm guest help with 55th and a reservist that was out there. He's just about to retire. Really good dude. And I was like, hey, where are the LAO slides? Just so I can review, you know, I've looked through the in-flight guide a little bit. And he's like, don't worry. I'll tell you everything you need to know. Well, we didn't really brief because we were just chilling. We go out and we're red air and we get shot. So he's like, all right, two, you're dead. You know, go ahead and spin back. And like the fight's ending, he's like, two, just go ahead and, you know, you can just go on home. I was like, I'm not doing that. Like I have attempted to learn the procedures and I still do not know them. So, so as like, I think I was an IP at the time, I was like, mm-mm, like I am staying with you. So, but yeah, it was good. It all worked out.
Yeah. I'd rather run out of fuel than get violated exiting the airspace.
Well, especially to the, what is that? To the south, like as red air, you know, all those step downs, like mm-mm, not for me.
Yeah. There's a few gotchas out there on that side of the airspace that like, I don't know what happened to you, but it wouldn't be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just run out. I'd rather run out of fuel too.
It would, or just like, you know, land at 800 pounds and just, you know, don't worry about it, you know, but yeah, that's, you know, hey, thanks for being guest help. You got our squadron in a lot of trouble. Like that's not what you want from your LAO.
Yeah.
Oh man. That was, I think the RTB, Rain, did you ever go to like Red Flag, Alaska?
No, of course not. Cause I was Shaw. So,
oh yeah,
there were no good deals to be had. I think like Red Flag, Alaska popped up on the radar once. And it was immediately changed to a coalition flag at Nellis. Unclass.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Woof, unclass flags. That's the way we want to be in life.
Jab a pin in my eye.
Yeah. Well, especially how frequently you would go to them, you know, like it's just, it seemed like that was just nonstop, especially for the Shaw squadrons. You're the deployed or at Nellis.
Well, it's like the best part, like every, you know what the deployment cycle is. And then the welcome home is like 2 months of like reconstitution, get spun back up. And then we need a capstone large force exercise. So let's send you to an unclass flag. And it's just like every time. I was just talking to an individual at one of your former places. And he said like, guess what? We're slated for a deployment. And guess what? We're slated for right when we come back, it's like a red flag. And you're like, first one's cool. Second one, you're like, I just don't want to get hit by some name country, whatever, that's going to go screaming through the altitude block in the middle of the night. And like, I was always, you know, being a W for a last name, it wasn't based on skill. They just forgot to put my puck somewhere. And so there would always be, oh, well, it was Rain's going to fly at night. So like, I did not fly daytime red flag ever. I only flew nights. I saw Nellis during the day for the first time doing WIC support, but I never flew a daytime red flag.
That's crazy.
It was terrible.
And those were like
the night train is the good train of like eventually. I don't know. It depends on what's going on. If I'm going to do an unclass, right, then I'm usually like, I'll do that. I'd almost prefer to be on the night, just because. The tier one red flags at night are just like all the admin that comes with that. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's painful.
Yeah. But I guess it's nice in the sense of like usually nighttime red flag, usually the DO, the weapons officer. It was always a good group of people on the night train.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, once you do it like four times, you're like, okay, I'm good.
Please.
I'm good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Vader.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was at McIntyre when we went to Red Flag and I was like, I'm happy to fly the night bulls. It was like a US only. And I was like, let's go. Like, let me, you know, see the thing. And they were like, no, we're okay. I was like, okay, I'll fly during the day. And then turns out it was like heinous weather during the day too. So what were you going to say, Bender?
The last one I went to, I was guest help. Well, I'm a reservist, so we're all kind of guest helpy. So they just like put you kind of where they either treat you one of two ways. Either you're like the trash that they just fill in where they like forget to, you know, like do the stuff that they were supposed to do. So you're the backfill. Or this squadron was awesome. They were like, oh, like, thanks for coming out. We're going to treat you like you get first choice of everything. So it was me and a guy who's awesome. He's a Navy Top Gun guy that joined our reserve unit. But they're like, what do you want to do? So we like picked our voles. We like picked when we wanted to be flight leads or whatever. And then the best part was they, because we were late additions to the red flag, they did not I don't know how this works, but it, to be able to get read into the ACC world of a tier one, you they have to like pay for the billets. You guys familiar with that?
No, oh. I don't know.
Interesting. Anyway, so they didn't pay for the billet for me and this guy, but bottom line, because I guess there was a certain amount of spots. So they're like, oh, like bummer, you're not going to be read in, so you can't do any of the mission planning. So you're just cleared off the days that you're not flying, and then we'll give you all our products. Yeah, when you fly, we'll just have it all ready for you. Whatever. Anyway, it was the best red flag I've ever been to. For sure. Like, wait.
Yeah, you can just.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Bender, because you've been to both. I don't have as much experience at Nellis as you do, but in my experience, I feel like Nellis seems more congested. Like it seems like everybody's way closer together. Maybe it's Red Flag Alaska. I just didn't have as much SA, so I didn't realize how many people were there. Do you think Nellis just has more jets or less space? Oh, that's not good.
He just hit end. Alaska,
gotta go.
They've had like one or two. It's been a while, like mid-airs, right? And there's one, I mean, it's out on YouTube, like two Eagle. I'm pretty sure it was an Eagle coming back that had that mid-air. I wonder, I don't even want to say it, but there has to have been a mid-air at Nellis, I would think. There's some, there were close passes when the ones we went to, they were pretty, it's amazing it doesn't happen more often, I guess. You know, we talked about like the last one with, like the mini blocks, where you got like four jets separated by 500 feet at night. Like that's just skosh. Bender's back, so that's good. Good answer.
I'm back. I lost the video froze for like the last 5 minutes. It's really awkward talking to two frozen individuals. Like, I don't know. Is this a funny story? I can't tell.
But yeah, I was asking if you thought that the Nellis airspace seemed more congested than the J Park up in Alaska. Do you think so or no?
Yeah. The J Park airspace is pretty full up. The limitations of awesome. J Park range is I think the ranges are more limited. So like the stuff on the ground is more geographically limited. Whereas at Nellis, they have them like kind of everywhere, but the airspace is more limiting at Nellis. So that part's like less fun.
Yeah. The cool part about like, especially doing seed in Alaska is that, you know, in the desert under the Knitter, I mean, you look out the window and you're like a slab of concrete in the middle of the desert. And you're like, oh, I found the surface air, you know, like missile site.
Right.
Where in Alaska, you like look out the window and it's just like rolling hills in like the Yukon tundra. And you're like, this is awesome. And it's just like trees. And you're like, oh, it's going to be difficult to find them. Like, it's not going to be just a simple task. That was one of my favorite parts. Like actually trying to find them on the ground was like, it was exciting.
Yeah. Cool. I would get pumped to go to a Red Flag Alaska. Like that's exciting. Like,
same.
Yeah.
That sounds nice. Cause I was just thinking like Red Flag, you know, like what you said, especially at night, because the emitters have a light on it. I'm trying to remember, like, it's a specific light. So talk about gamesmanship of just, like, defensive BFM, just get to the horn as fast as possible. Like, I'm just going to look outside with my laser beam to slew the targeting pod to it. And like, oh, look what I found.
Yeah, that's – we never had night vols in Red Flag Alaska, because turns out it's in the summer and the sun doesn't set.
Yeah,
so we really carry night vols all the time. But yeah, that's which is it's crazy. It's cool that you get to do these red flags. How, like you said, like it's amazing that there aren't more midairs. There aren't more crazy things with people with real bombs, people with simulated bombs, real people on the range, like manning equipment. And you're like, this is, you know, you kind of have a good, healthy respect for like everybody needs to do their job or this could go sideways.
That is a good point, because it is impressive when you really think about the amount of iron that's getting put up into the air, going same way, same day, doing a mission, doing multiple mission sets inside of there in a relatively confined piece of sky. You know, when you're talking about that much flying around, it is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So look, that was a positive spin there. Positive. So.
That was good.
Yeah.
I feel like I should probably tap that up with some. You know, obviously, yeah, it's all for you to say, but
bring it back to reality.
That's funny. The worst, have you guys done green flags? I assume you guys have done green flags.
Yeah.
Right? I heard it was terrible.
Yeah, they're not great for the air guys, for sure. But the Army dudes, like, that's their, I mean, from what I understand, at least the one we went to, like, three dudes died, like, on the ground. So it's like a full level, it's like a life-threatening event for a lot of them. And also, there's, like, 10,000 of them, so. But like when we were there, I think some truck Humvee rolled or something and killed, and three of them died. So it's kind of sad, but it is cool. But there's like two of you and then there's 10,000 Army dudes like maneuvering around on the ground. You're like, it's pretty full up. Like that's a lot of coordination and effort that those guys are doing. And then they do it for, I think they're there for like a month, just in the middle of the desert, walking around, shooting it. I don't even know what they shoot at, but.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I talked to this captain who's in the Army, and it's crazy that he was like a, first lieutenant or a captain, and he like leads like 300 people, and in the Air Force, you just don't do that as a fighter pilot. But he was talking about exactly that, like green flag. They do calculations and they're like, all right, we're going to have this many people out in the field for this many days. Like we expect real world X number of deaths. And it's just the way their human capital is just allocated so differently than the Air Force, which is, it's hard to even like understand that. Cause in the Air Force, if there was one person gets out or if there's a midair, anything like that, it's like full stop, figure out what's going on. But
yeah.
Crazy.
It's crazy. One of the coolest things I ever did was in a green flag. So it was my two ship, and then they wanted us to coordinate with Apache squadron or whatever they call. I don't know what they call them, like air battalion. I don't know what it was, but so we flew out. It was cool. They came and picked us up in, air cap. Sure.
I don't know. I made that up.
Yeah, sounds legit. We're gonna have to edit this little part out. Yeah. But they flew us out in Black Hawks to go like mission plan with the Apache squadron, so it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So we planned, but what they wanted us to do is they would have like they had like six or eight Apaches, I can't remember how many, but they were gonna be behind these hills we're gonna do an airfield takedown. So we were gonna like hit strategic spots with our bombs, and then they were gonna pop up as soon as the bombs blew up, and then like roll in with rockets, and then they'd hide behind the hills because they were close, and we'd drop our second set of bombs, and this is all with like live bombs, and they'd pop up and like lay waste with their 50 cals and rockets again or whatever, and then we'd all like take turns strafing whatever was left, and it was a rager. It was freaking awesome to see those guys just like, they're like just hovering. So we'd like fly over, and you see these eight Apaches just hovering like 5 feet or whatever. And as soon as the weapons went off, they like popped up, and it was just like from both sides, just like this wall of firepower coming down. Like, dude, those dudes are legit. That would be a fun job to have if like, no kidding, things were going down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I worked with some Apaches when I was doing the MC-12 thing in Afghanistan, like one lazing for guys placing IEDs in the Apaches, cleaned up that problem very quickly. But the most impressive thing I saw them do, we were supporting some Australian SAS dudes, like walking up this valley. They got into a firefight, and the Apaches were like 15 minutes out. They like rolled in, and the amount of destruction that it was a two ship of Apaches caused. I mean, like hellfires are going. Is it 50 cal or is it like what do they have? 30? I don't even know what they have.
I don't know.
I don't remember.
It was destroying everything. It would be a lot of fun to fly one of those.
Yeah.
Flip side is, you're down low, and I think they tend to get shot by like surface air or shoulder fire weapons. But,
yeah, that part's not ideal. Yeah.
I mean, even like AK-47s, yeah, I mean, they are in and amongst them. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you chaff off the, small arms man pads part of the brief, you have to pay attention to that in Apache.
Yeah.
Especially black.
I guess they don't think about like SA-21s, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because they're like, oh, I'm getting shot, and they just land, not a problem anymore.
Also that's valid.
Yeah, you say that because one of our Pats just went to SAMU in Huntsville, Alabama. I guess that's where they have like the legit MISIC dudes who teach the academics. And so the first 4 days were like long-range SAMs, medium-range SAMs, some other, and then the last day, the last half of the last day was like, you know, the shoulder fired man pads or whatever, but they had Army Intel and Apache patches, whatever their equivalent is. They were there the entire week, just like, like not caring. And then they fought like the last half of the last day, they finally like tell us all about this or whatever. He was like, and it was pretty funny. They spent the entire week just listening to this. Like, what are the jamming effects on the SA-21 and all this? And they're like, oh my gosh.
I went to a warfighter in Savannah where like Raytheon brings all their engineers and, you know, tells you about like the AIM-120 and the AIM-9 and stuff. And it's like, was it, I think it's Friday. Yeah. Friday afternoon class is the AIM-9 mic. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to go to that. Like that's about as bad as AIM-9 gets. Yeah. I'm not worried about it. So.
If I'm shooting an AIM-9 mic, I don't know. It's just, it's all, I've expended all options at this point and see what happens.
Yeah. Just give me another ACMI pod. So at least I track. I'd rather have that.
Although I'll say our like WESUP, we went for the missile shoot. I got to shoot a AIM-120 Delta, which was cool. I mean, it was cool for like 3 seconds. I'm like, well, I don't see anymore, but it was cool to be able to do that. We had a lot of 9 mics and I think we went home with like 7 guys not getting to shoot because they kept spearing the drone with the 9 mic. I mean, it was just out there slaying all day long. And they're like, if you guys, this is the last drone. Like if this one gets hit, like if it doesn't flare it off or whatever, like that's it. That's all you got. We have no more drones. So like 7 dudes seeing us shoot missiles because of that.
My squadron must have gone after when you went, because their new tactic by the time I went was they turn the drone and they're like, whether you are inside of the range of your missile, shoot the missile. Like, so you like the drone's driving at you and you're like, oh yeah, just a little bit more and he's going to be right there. And then they turn the drone and they're like, just shoot the missile. Like, if you don't shoot, we have to have EOD blow these things up. So I was like, I don't care. Like, send it. So yeah, like outside the 9 mics, like effective range. And I was like, whatever, it doesn't matter. But yeah, I shot a 9 mic.
That's cool. I never got a shot air to air. Arm is cool.
Shoot a Maverick?
I don't think I have shot a Maverick. I've captive carried.
Maverick was because we captive carried in Misawa. And then when I got to McIntyre, I got to shoot a 9 mic and then shot a Maverick. And that was pretty cool. It comes off the rail slow. You know how the harm was like out of there?
Yeah.
It was like pickle. Oh, no. And then by the time you turn to the missile, it's like off your wing. It looks like the space shuttle is taking off. And like I check left because it flies like 0.4. Like pull the power and I'm like a beam the Maverick until it like dips over down to the target. And I was like, sweet. No, it's cool.
That's kind of funny. Did you do the harm shoot in Guam, Vader, Dex planned? I think you did it, but the plan was, and you can fill me in if I'm wrong, but it was like 7 out on the leading edge. We're going to shoot. And then 7, like in 10 miles trail, we're going to shoot after they shot on this one emitter.
Yeah.
And the idea was that we shoot in the harm flight profile is supposed to go, you know, it's supposed to go up until it reaches its range or whatever. And nobody, for whatever reason, like thought about the ranges that we were going to shoot at. So the first guys like shoot, I'm in the first wave and I like shoot the thing. I'm like, this is going to be sick. It's just going to be like off the rail and like up, but it goes like straight down at the, cause we're so close to it. I'm like, oh crap. Cause there's 7 jets right behind me who are about to rip off their harm. And the plan was for us to like shoot and then like just go out low and turn around so it's going to be like 7 crossing 7 as there are harms like flying past the first 7. I'm like, this is terrible. So I think all of us basically went to the surface like, please don't get hit. Please don't get hit.
Yeah. I think we aborted our pass. Yeah. I think because I was in the second group. I was like on Dexter's wing and cause it was like, you know, we see everybody out low and we're like, oh geez. And then like, you know, the emitter's off air and we're like, oh, what are we going to do? And it's like, shoot him anyway. And then same thing, like right under the nose and you're like, oh, that is gone, you know, but
hopefully no one's there.
Yeah. But that was sweet. That was a good time.
Yeah. I wish The one thing that, I mean, I just wish I could shoot Harms in combat. That'd be so sick. F-35s don't carry them, but maybe one day we'll, I mean, they strapped them on MiG-29, so maybe we'll figure out a way to strap them on some F-35s.
There you go. I had the ultimate story, just like top rope. When I was at McIntyre, cause those dudes are mustard. I mean, they've been around. I was talking to one of the dudes and we were just kind of, you know, sharing stories like this. And, somebody asked if I'd shot a Harm. I was like, yeah, I shot a Harm. It was at Guam. And, I was like, I want to same thing. I want to shoot one like real far. Like I want to see it go. And one of the guys was like, oh, I got to do one of those. I was like, oh man, like that's gotta be like a lot of coordination to get a Harm shot that goes like way up in the bososphere. And I was like, where'd you do it? And he was like, Kosovo. And I was like, good.
Coordination complete.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, shoot, that's, yeah, exactly. So I was like, well, that's good. I'm glad some people have those stories.
Yeah. Funny. Bender Miller, didn't he, or was it Freak Casey? So one of those two has like the most Harms shot in combat, I think, because of Kosovo. Wow. Beat a Kosovo wingman when they're just like, sniper this, sniper that. Like every sortie, they're just shooting two Harm, going back and landing and going back out the next day.
Yeah, the trade-off with that is someone's shooting back at you most likely.
Yeah.
With the teleport pole. Yeah.
Yeah. That was Bender Miller. That was his. Like he like literally glib-2'd off like a Sam.
SA-3, right? And yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, whew, that's
hardcore. Also, on one of his sorties, I don't know how many air-to-air kills there were, but there weren't very many even in Kosovo, but he was the wingman and he's like, it was the only time in the entire war where I had like SA on what they were saying, like on the fight frequency or whatever. So he hears them, like these Eagles are starting to declare this, like they're declaring this contact off their nose, like 20 miles or whatever. And he's like listening and they're not responding. So they're like, declare whatever. They're not responding. And as soon as they like get within like 10 miles of this thing, it's at night. So he like sees the shadow and they like cross over the shadow and they're like, hostile MiG-29, like as they pass over, and then the Eagles shoot it down like 20 miles behind him. He's like, ah, like my one chance at a freaking air to air kill. Like I visually watched him pass underneath us.
Oh man,
gonna kill it.
That's some wild stuff, you know, like talking about going to Iraq and Syria and all that. And it's like different wars, you know,
for sure.
Yeah.
There's a whole different problem set.
Yeah. All right. Well, I got to get going, boys. This has been awesome. We'll get all this content out to everybody. Thank you everybody for listening. Rain, do you want to do a sign us out if you're interested?
I do not. I'm actually not interested in doing that at all. But no, thanks for everyone listening. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten a lot of feedback on my podcast that people, this is a different format from most of mine. They just like, you know, hearing people talk. And maybe after this might be the one that breaks the camel's back, straw breaks the camel's back. Like, you guys don't do that anymore. That was absolutely terrible. So, yeah. Thanks for making this happen. Again, technology, Japan, California, Utah. I mean, look at us now. Who would have thought? So many years ago, we'd be doing a podcast across the globe. So that's all I got.
Yeah.
It's a great closeout.
Yeah, sweet. Thanks, guys. Yeah.
All right.
See you guys. Hey, thanks, guys. See ya.
As always, thanks for listening in. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Check out Kodiak Shack with Vader and Bender. As always, drop a rating and review over on iTunes. That helps the podcast out. We'll see you next time. Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.